physical activity, cooking, or hobby. What thing during the pandemic did you reach for comfort?
What if cooking is your hobby? What if physical activity is your hobby?
Well, I mean, you get to choose.
But the
Alan just threw a hobby in on this one as like a miscellaneous cop out.
Right, like if you said like a craft,
I mean,
that'd be
fine. If you really want to push me, I can say like instead of physical or instead of hobby, I can say nostalgic television show.
That's not remotely what I said, but fine. Yes, it's better than just hobby.
Fine. Media nostalgia. Watched,
no,
like,
now
binging
you're broadening
something.
It again.
I know.
Whatever. Okay. Yeah.
Look, so, I tried to give you more options and you complained. You should have taken the first one.
I just want you to get
okay,
good at
I'm
this.
I'm breaking in. Physical activity.
All right.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're welcome.
Did you have a specific physical activity that you went for during the pandemic?
Yeah, I walked a lot and walked in nature specifically. I mean, I guess that's kind of what you do when you walk outside, but it's all nature out there. But we have a forest, a park down the street from our house, and we got a dog in the middle of the pandemic. And so lots of walking in the woods and walking in other neighborhoods and that kind of thing.
Nice.
So, and I actually started resistance training.
Ooh.
During the pandemic. So, yes.
Very cool.
Ashley, Kyle.
I think I'm going to go with physical activity as well because I mean, Alan, you see what I eat when you're not home.
Potatoes.
Yeah, it's well. The last time he was away, I had like raisin bran and black tea for dinner, and that's like. What I had because I just didn't feel like, it's more of a consumption of time thing. It's not that I don't like good food. I'm just really lazy. So unless I'm cooking for other people, I don't care.
I affectionately refer to it as Ashley being a bachelorette trash panda when I'm not around to cook.
He'll be like, yeah, what'd you have for dinner? And I'm like, oh, some mashed potatoes and peas. Or...
like beer and popcorn.
Yeah, that too sometimes. Like if it's already pre-made.
Dinner of champions.
Yeah, exactly. I've got other stuff I want to do. So yeah, physical activity. I had been running a bit prior to moving, but then, you know, during the pandemic, because you had pretty much nothing else to do.
Yep.
I ran a ton, and now that we're both gainfully employed members of society, we're a little more structured about it just because we have to be with work schedules, but I would say physical activity. It's hard to think about anything else that you're stressed about when you're breathing really heavily.
Kyle, what about you?
I mean, what did I reach for? Magic the Gathering. The physical activity thing kind of fell into my lap because I was building a house throughout a significant chunk of the pandemic. So like we're into summer programming again at work this week, and so now I get the joy of experiencing, oh, I can just work like maybe a little over full time during the week, and then I don't have to go home and like build a house. This is amazing. This is great. It's just built. I can just go home and there's a bed there and I can sleep in it. It's awesome.
That is a good feeling. I definitely can see where that would be better than doing both.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Yeah, I think for me, like, I think it's going to be pretty unanimous on this one. Like, physical activity, like, I know.
Really? You aren't going to go cooking? I thought sure, because you included it, that you'd do cooking.
I did a lot of cooking, like, to
you
be fair.
You do
but
a lot of cooking.
I do a lot of cooking, but that was also something that was happening before pandemic and has happened since pandemic. Like, mm-hmm. I was cooking a lot. I do 90% of the cooking anyway, because I just enjoy it more.
Right.
But that really didn't change during the pandemic. It just happened to be we were living with your brother. And I would just cook for the house versus just cooking for you and I. So the quantity went up.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of time or the number of meals I was cooking per week really didn't change. It just kind of scaled in volume versus in quantity. I guess that's probably a better way to phrase it.
Sure.
But I was doing some physical activity before we left Scotland and when we came back. But as soon as we got in the pandemic and all the job search shut down last March, it was like, welp, okay, we're writing for a website. That takes a couple hours a day, and I'm not going to give it more time than I need to get the pay that I'm being paid.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a lot of hours left in the day. Had all the running stuff, had my bicycle back. So I was like, I'm going to start running and riding a lot. So I was running 3 days a week, 3 to 4 days a week, and then riding on Saturday or Sunday, typically for anywhere from 15 to 35 miles. So it just was go out for a nice 2-3 hours and ride the bike, or go out in the morning before it got too hot.
Well, and now you're wanting to train for a triathlon.
Yeah, so I'm literally mid. I got a text message from somebody here in Tennessee who was inviting me to go on a training ride tomorrow morning for 50 miles, but I'm literally midway between swapping handlebar sets. So I got a set of triathlon bars, which, to get super nerdy, it's the type, they have aero bars, but the straight bars that you can lay down on while you're riding to be more aerodynamic, and these have shifters on the front, so I can shift gears without having to move my arms, and then the only time I have to move my arms is when I need to go for the brakes. So it's super nice. However, to put them on, you have to strip all the wires off. So week and a half back, I got all the new wire. I just haven't had a chance to sit down and actually put my bars back together and, you know, be able to change gears and use the brakes. So probably shouldn't take the bicycle out on the road like that.
It's probably you have like your brake lines reconnected. Yes, please.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just the things you kind of need when you're cycling.
I don't know, Alan. I think you should live dangerously.
Don't encourage him.
Well, look, people ride fixies and they have no brakes or they have a single gear. So it's basically what it is right now.
I mean, you don't have to have no brakes. Just like hold the brake line in one hand. That way, when you're ready, you just give it a good yank, you know.
That would be funny if I even had the brake line like attached to be able to do that. But it literally has been detached from the bolts. So the only way I can brake right now is kicking a foot back and manually braking and trying not to break my ankle at the same moment.
Like breaking a foot back.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
Just want to take a minute to remind you guys that we are working in partnership with Thy Geekdom Come to help promote their latest book, Thy Geekdom Come Volume 2. As geeks, we have our own language, our own culture, and now our own devotional. Thy Geekdom Come is not your average devotional. It's made by geeks, for geeks, with the depth that geeks need in their fandoms and also want in their faith. Thy Geekdom Come Volume 2 and a 5-day free version is now available at geekdevo.com. That's GEEKDEVO.com. Our very own Ashley Mowers has two of the devotionals in this version, GEEKDEVO.com. All right, back to the show.
Gosh.
But yes. Hello, my ampersands. This is episode 183 of the MinMax podcast. Hope this finds you well. Today, we are joined by a returning guest. It has been almost 4 years. Because it was 2017, I believe, the last time we all sat down around a table to record.
Yeah, it was.
Because it would have been late. It was either late 2017 or early 2018.
Might have been early 18.
It might have been January of 18. But it has been a minute, for sure. We are joined by the lovely friend of the show, the Reverend Dr. Cindy Wallace. How are you, Cindy?
Hi, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm doing well. This is what I say to myself when people ask me those kinds of questions. Because
I was going to say, you said it with such conviction.
Most people really don't want to hear my stories. So yeah, I'm fine. I'm great. I'm good.
No, we have you on so we can hear the stories because we enjoy the stories so much.
So let me get into that headspace. Yeah, so what came out was the other. What came out was what usually happens when somebody in the family says, how was your day? I'm like, oh, it's good. Good day. Good day. Good day. You know, everything's good. Everything's good here. How are you? How was your day? Yeah. They really don't want to know. And they can tell by the tone of my voice whether they should ask a follow-up question or not. So, and usually if it's Rob, he'll be like, I will call and on my way home say, hey, I'm on my way home. He's like, everything okay? How's work today? Like, you sound like you had more busy work today. You were doing administrative work. I was like, yeah, I'm exhausted. I was doing administrative work. But if I've been seeing patients and had groups, then, you know, I'm a little more chipper. But if it's been a lot of difficult stuff with patients and groups and phone calls and just general tragedy and sadness, it was an okay day. No follow-up questions. All right. If she's saying it was an okay day, we do not need to ask anything else. Okay, let's move on. And if I need to talk about it, I will tell him. I will talk to him about it. But he will definitely give Thomas the heads up. Like, mom's had a bad day. Just heads up. Mom's had a bad day. Everybody, everybody clear? Everybody clear? No follow-up questions at dinner tonight. You do not want to know what happened. So, yeah.
I can definitely understand that. My default in that mode, I did it this week because it has been a bit of a stressful week. I went out for a run one night and I caught Ashley as like she was driving in as I was heading out on the run. And she just kind of rolled the window. I'm just like, oh, you're going? I'm like, I will be a much more pleasant human being if I go run 2 miles and then come back. Trust me when I say I will be a much more pleasant human being. And she was like, okay, bye.
Say no more. Yeah.
The worst, like at times, I question what my family who have jobs actually do at their jobs, because like I get the family chat will get going in the middle of the day and I'm just like, for the love of God, I'm working. What are you people doing? Stop dinging my phone all the time. And so every once in a while, I can't remember what it was that Val and Rob and I were on something and she was asking about something, but it was, I can't remember. I wish I could find it. It was something just random, like asking about, what do you guys think about blah, 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 blah. Do you like this color or that color? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when I finally looked at it, I was like, I am with someone who is suicidal. I cannot answer these questions right now. Like, stop texting me. I have a real job. I don't know what you guys do, but I have a real job. It's a big girl job and everything.
It's so funny you bring that up too, because Alan and I will compare days and he'll describe what is like ultimately a very basic corporate job, which for him being at the director level, obviously has a lot of stress and responsibility that comes with it, but it's the type of stress and responsibility that makes my eye twitch. And I'm just like, you have to stop talking about it. It is stressing me out. And he's like, you don't even know any of these people. I'm like, I don't have to. It's stressing me out. I'm worried for them. And then I'll explain like things people have told me at work. And he's like, that sounds awful. I'm like, oh, that was just the day. It was really all right. Like, I can handle that. That's no problem. Crisis of faith? Totally. Done.
dealing with interpersonal communication stuff. And like,
well, no, interpersonal communication's fine. It's more like the bottom line stuff.
Oh, yeah, dealing with financials and all that jazz. Like, no. Yeah, it's the nasty admin side of business, to where you, like, if you're not hitting the marks and you're not hitting your KPIs and stuff, when things start getting interesting, to say the least.
This is why Rob is the pastor, mm-hmm. and I am not, because people will be like, I don't understand why we have to move the church service in the summer to 10 a.m. I mean, that's just too early for me. Or the 11 o'clock that, you know, are like, that's just too early. And then the 8:30 people are like, that's just too late. And I'm like, okay, I have someone who murdered his wife, who's been out of jail for 20 years and is now suicidal himself, dealing with the shame and guilt. I have someone whose loved one just died in an accident. I have this person whose both parents died from COVID this year and they lost their job. I'm like, talk to me again about a 10 o'clock service. Yeah, come at me.
Exactly.
Come at me. I've got nothing. You guys really need a real life if this is what you have to argue about and to fuss about. I'm like, nope, I can't do that.
Yep,
like,
nope. I empathize with that so much, because there's just like just some of the standard church stuff that Ashley deals with. I'm just like, being an Enneagram 8 and operating something, like, I start twitching and I'm like, no, you just do this. It's this simple. And I was like, Alan, it's not that easy. I'm like, but it is. She's like, but Alan, I have to convince these people. I was like, no, you don't. You just have to smack their heads together and say, do it.
She's like, Alan, they're volunteers, not employees.
And it's just like, yes, yeah, then exactly. Tell them what they need to do. Like, this is what you need to do.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm an Enneagram 8 as well. And I, you know, have been in leadership positions and have been in management and stuff, I had to learn how to manage my very direct 8-ness so that I could manage people well. And I did that really, really well. But now I'm not in management anymore. I still have some leadership responsibilities in different areas, but I have a chief and I'm not the chief. And I thought when I first started this job in DC a couple of years ago, that was going to be a little weird. And like, I've been a manager for, you know, the last 8 years. How am I going to fit into a team and not be the manager? And oh my God, I have loved it so much. I'm just like, oh yeah, you gotta listen to his crap. Yep, sorry. How about this? When you get off the phone to him having to listen to his crap, I'll come in and shut the door and you can vent to me, because I totally get it, and it's safe. I get it. You can do that with me. So that I'm like, I'm supporting my boss, and I'm the one that she will, you know, me and another person that I work with, she came in the office one day and was like, oh my God, you have to come to my office and shut the door. I have to tell you something. We're like, okay. Like, it was just one of those, I have to tell somebody who's not going to be upset about it. So, you know, we can do that together. And that's a lovely ministry. She's also an 8, by the way. So
you just feed off of each other.
Yes.
But that's right. Yes. Your job has changed since the last time that you've been on. Can you tell us a little bit about your new role?
Yes. So I am the mental health chaplain at the Washington, D.C. VA Medical Center. And I am also, as part of my mental health chaplain responsibilities, I have become the co-chair of our critical incident stress management team that we actually started in March of last year. Go figure. They didn't have one. I had been kind of, since I came there, pushing for one. And then all of a sudden in March of 2020, go figure, the regional office called the VISN said, every hospital in our VISN needs a critical incident stress management team. I was like, you think? Yeah, we needed it like 20 years ago, yeah. But right now you're absolutely right. We need one. And so myself and a psychologist worked together to pull together a team. And honest to God, we talked about it one day. We pulled a team together within a week and started training them. And before we even got through that first week, we had an employee die from COVID. Mm. And it was like, oof. Okay, time to work. Hope your training was good. Let's go. You know? I mean, it was like, hit the ground running.
Yeah.
So we did that. And I'm also the co-lead for our suicide postvention team. Postvention is basically support for employees and staff and families of veterans that kick in after a veteran dies by suicide. Mm. And so we support the staff who were their providers, and we do outreach to the family and close friends and provide grief support to them and referrals to them for within the community for grief support and follow them for about a year if they opt into that. So that's my current position. I'm also one of the things that I signed on to do when I got there was to help with our Warrior to Soulmate program. So I am a Warrior to Soulmate facilitator. That is our veteran and partner program where we do communication relationship workshops. And so we facilitated some of those online this last year, just like kind of an introductory piece. And we're looking to start that back up in face-to-face in the fall to follow up with those couples. And so just kind of got my fingers in all kinds of pies there. My main responsibility as the mental health chaplain is to provide support to our inpatient mental health locked unit there, as well as our outpatient mental health services in addictions, in recovery and rehab, psychological recovery and rehab, in trauma services. And so we do groups and such in those areas. And I also am now leading the effort to do grief groups for our veterans. Mm-hmm. We had someone doing that, and then she retired in 2020. We had a lot of people who retired in 2020. Huh. So, yeah, go figure. They were like, it's time. I'm out. Not coming back. So can't say that. Can't say that I blame them. You're that close. I'm sure that pushed a lot of people over to the retirement part, not just in healthcare. But yeah, so she retired, and that left a void in our grief support services. So I am supporting the veterans at the Washington, D.C. VA Medical Center in grief support, along with all the other things. So
it sounds like what I'm hearing is that you have a lot of time on your hands.
Like, at one point, I looked at my boss, was like, is no one else doing this? She said, am I the only one providing grief support to all of our veterans in D.C.? And she looked at me, and she kind of squeezed her face, and she reached over and grabbed my hand. She said, aw, yeah, you are. Thanks. Thanks. Like, that's so cute that you think somebody else is doing it. No, nobody else is doing it. But we've hired some help. We're getting her trained, and we're splitting up the responsibilities. So we're figuring it out. But
wow. Dang. So, that's
been a lot.
That is a lot, but that's incredibly impressive how much tenacity you've demonstrated. I mean, I think I tell everybody that you need to have at least one chaplain friend just like to keep yourself grounded, to really like understand just how much one person has the capacity to just like take on and to withstand.
You know it's it's bad when your own therapist looks at you in your session and says, I don't know how you do what you do. Like, thanks? Should I be crying for help? Right. I mean, you're my therapist. What do you mean? What am I supposed to do with that? Yeah. I just don't know how you do it. But, you're supposed to be figuring that out for me, helping me figure that out. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Man. And yeah, so like you said, you'd started building all of these different programs right when COVID hit. Something we've been really curious about and we've started talking about is how various aspects of life, and in this case, trauma, can affect identity. And one of the reasons why the question had come to mind for me, at least personally, was because now that our church is starting to meet back in person, I've had a lot of people start having conversations about things that now deeply stress them out that didn't used to, and even things unrelated to COVID that now they're just really anxious about. So I've been curious as to how trauma shapes identity, how recovery shapes identity, and what kind of marks those leave on personalities.
Wow. Okay. And how long do we have here?
As long as you want, baby.
Okay. Yeah. No. Those are great questions. And one of the things that I think is I think people are not realizing, but I think they are soon realizing. Maybe they are just now. Is how much trauma we have all taken in the last year. There are two kinds of trauma. There's primary trauma, something that happens directly to you. And then there's secondary or vicarious trauma, you witnessing something happening, or you hearing the story of something happening. And we've experienced a lot of both. We have had loved ones who have been sick or who have died. We have had, and you know, it's not just COVID, right? Because what I found in the grief group is that it's not just my aunt died of cancer or my mom died of Alzheimer's anymore. It's what I'm getting now is my mom died of Alzheimer's. My dad died of COVID. I had two cousins that died of COVID. I had an aunt and an uncle. And so by the time they get to me just for a grief consult, they've had multiple losses in a matter of, you know, 6 to 9 months. It's not just, I know someone who died from COVID. It's, I've experienced between 2 to 5 deaths in the last 6 months of people close to me. And so, I mean, that's serious trauma right there. Mm-hmm. On top of that, you've got the anxiety, especially at the beginning, that everybody experienced of, kind of that not knowing what to do, like, are we supposed to wear masks now? Oh, we are. We're supposed to wear masks now. Are we supposed to wear gloves everywhere now too? Okay, wait. And I'm not supposed to touch my face. Can I touch my face now? No, I can't touch my face. Okay, I have to wash my hands for how long? I mean, and then, you know, it's changing and it's, you can't, the cloth masks are okay, but, you know, from a healthcare perspective, it was wear whatever mask you can find. And then it was, we're running out of masks. So make sure that you put your mask in a paper bag so that it can aerate out, not in a plastic bag, because that's not good, but the paper bag allows for airflow. And then you can reuse it until it has visible dirt on it. Like, okay, that's not how we've ever used these masks before, but sure, that's safe. Fine. You know, right. Okay. So, people are scared and they're wearing two masks, or they're trying to get their hands on an N95 and wearing an N95 and then a cloth mask over it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I had nurses who were not getting enough oxygen because they were trying to mask, you know, two masks, and then they had the gown, and then they had the hairnet, and had the gloves,
yeah,
and they had the footies. And so, you know, you're working with patients like this all day, and some of them were even so scared to take their mask off that they would either go eat out in their car because they wouldn't go to the break room and take their mask off, or they would just not eat until they got off shift. And wow. So, which, like, that's not okay. You've got to eat. You've got to drink. You can't, you know, you're going to dehydrate. You can't. So, you know, you have all that fear at the beginning because we don't know what we don't know, mm-hmm. right? And then, so you've got all that. And then in the middle of trying to figure out what we don't know and how are we managing this, and okay, now we kind of think we got a handle on what to do with this, then you've got George Floyd's death, and you've got a trauma where you can literally watch someone be murdered in front of you. Mm-hmm. Now, not that you could not have watched someone be murdered before. I'm not saying that. We have plenty of war footage that was real. We have, you know, we have war movies. We have, you know, violence in, on TV and stuff that's not really real, but it's realistic. But this particular violent act, it wrecked the nation, right? Thank God it wrecked the nation, but it wrecked the nation. And so you have this vicarious trauma for some of us, but I would even say for our African-American brothers and sisters, for the people of color, I dare say that's a primary trauma. Mm. It's not secondary. It's not vicarious. It's a primary trauma because it was like, and I've heard so many of my friends say it was like watching a lynching. Even if you haven't had, if none of us have ever had the experience of necessarily watching a lynching, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
That's how it's been described by many people. And so you have that trauma on top of what was already fear and anxiety and, you know, trauma about going out of your house, about getting groceries, and such as that. So we have had trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma for the last year and a half. And so the fact that people are anxious now about the CDC saying, oh, you're vaccinated? You don't need a mask anymore. Go ahead, group together. Get in there for the photo. Yeah, everybody right there next to each other. You're good. You're all good. And, you know, the rest of us are like, don't touch me. You better stay back. Like, I don't know you. Mm-hmm. So, like, you go from stay away from people. It's not safe to no, it's okay. Take your mask off. You're vaccinated. You're good. You can have large groups. It's all good. Everything's fine now. Nothing to see here. Like, I'm sorry. Like, no, I think I'm going to still mask and I'm going to wash my hands. And I think you better not try to hug me when we come together at church, because I love you, but I can love you from over here. And I know you're vaccinated, but don't touch me. I'm just not ready. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's nerve wracking, you know, it's just nerve wracking. And for some people, you know, some people are ready, so ready to be out and about that it's a different kind of anxiety. It's like a happy, nervous, giddy anxiety. Like, oh my God, everybody's, we can go. And for some people, it's like, it's still fearful anxiety because, again, we don't know what we don't know.
Sure.
There's still that uncertainty. And now we've got to try to figure out what's the next step. What are things going to look like now? As much as people like to talk about things going back to normal, mm-hmm. that's not a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normal is, you know, over half a million people in our country have died. That's not normal. There is no let's go back to normal after this, because our entire country on some level is traumatized. And so there's a way forward, but it's not going backwards. It's in trying to figure out what forward is. So yeah, there's going to be nerves. There's going to be fear. There's going to be anxiety. And my hope is that if we do this right, it will, the process and the growth that can come out of this will be fantastic. But my fear is, that's my hope, my fear is that people will do what people have always wanted to do and just sweep it all under the rug and not talk about it and ignore the trauma. Like, oh, it's over. It's over. You should just get over it now. And I don't think people realize it's not going to be over for anybody who's experienced the loss of a loved one. It's not going to be over for any of our frontline healthcare workers, because many of them have been experiencing PTSD since this thing started, or at least post-traumatic stress symptoms since this thing started and people started dying. People who were not able to be with their loved one when they died, mm-hmm. that's a trauma that they are still dealing with that adds to the grief that they're experiencing. And then you have just the whole racial conversations that are happening, which is good, but trying to navigate that, that it's uncomfortable, right? We come out of this not in really stasis, but in a place of discomfort, and that's hard. That's really hard. Mm. We don't like being uncomfortable. We don't like silence, and we don't like being uncomfortable. So we're in a very interesting place right now. And trauma has definitely shapes who we are from the get-go. And I can talk about that a little bit later, but this recent trauma is not just shaping us, but it's shaping our nation, and it's shaping groups of us, mm-hmm. In ways that we don't know what the outcome's going to be yet. So, yeah, that was a very long answer, and I don't even know that I answered your question, but that's kind of
no, what you're I good. Think it's you. A broad topic, and you've given a really thorough answer, I think, to a couple things. I don't want to leapfrog my other two co-hosts on another question, so I want to give you space to respond to that if you would like.
I think my only thought I think the social dimensions of what's happening are still yet to be felt in a lot of ways. I think there's a lot of change that's really, I mean, there has been a lot of change that's been brewing under the surface for a long time, right? And I think as is the case with a lot of crises, it has now opened the door for that change to bubble to the surface, and now it's got to resolve itself, right? Where a lot of these sort of lingering questions, I mean, I don't know what it's like in other places, but I know around here the job market is just absolutely crazy, because it's like everybody's hiring and everybody's looking for work, and somehow the twains are not meeting, right? Like somehow everybody needs jobs, everybody is looking for help, and it's just not clicking, right? And I think there's a huge number of factors that play into that. And I think, you know, it's things like that where there have been these lingering questions about jobs and the value of workers and, you know, just different things like that. You know, I see in my role, very early on in the pandemic, I was asked to join a panel for our local United Way on after school programs and kids and how the pandemic was affecting kids and things like that. And that was one of the things that I brought up early on, you know, because a lot of parents were freaking out about, like, what am I going to do? My kid's missing all this school, and now what if they get held back? And like, every parent is freaking out about this. And it's one of those, like, everybody needs to stop and take a breath, because, yes, your student is missing all this school, but so is literally every other student on the planet, right? So we need to stop and take some perspective here, because if every single kid is behind, no kid is behind, right? And it's so disruptive. The pandemic was so disruptive on so many just kind of fundamental levels that I think that itself becomes a trauma, right? Is just the disruption of routine is terrible. I mean, I have to hammer this with staff at work all the time, how important it is for kids to have routine and have boundaries and have consistency. Mm-hmm. And as much as kids don't say they want that, And as much as adults say, like, no, I don't want that. I don't need a schedule. Like, we want that. It is a very human trait for us to want schedule consistency. We don't like change. And so something that disrupts the fundamental sort of process of our lives on such a drastic level really does. I mean, even for those of us who have been able to go through the pandemic relatively unscathed, so to speak, you know, we're not going to go through it unaffected. And I think that's absolutely agree with you there, Cindy, that this is a conversation that we need to have and continue having over the next several years and possibly, you know, the next decade and longer as we're actually looking at, like, how did this affect us and how did this now shape the new world that we live in?
Absolutely. And one of the things you said about routine, routine is one of the things that we use as a coping strategy for our vets, for trauma, for anxiety, for addictions. We try to make sure, even for transition from the military to civilian life, one of the things that is so helpful in the military is that there is so much structure and so much discipline and so much routine. And then you exit that into civilian life where, you know, there's some structure, but it's not nearly the amount of structure or routine or chain of command, or, you know, it's not laid out as clearly as the military does. And so, you know, people who are transitioning out of the military really struggle. Some of them struggle with trying to find that sense of purpose, that sense of mission, that sense of structure in their life. And when someone doesn't have structure, that's when, you know, you start feeling uneasy. That's when the anxiety comes in, the worry comes in, when you don't have any kind of positive distractions to keep out the negative thoughts, the negative unhelpful thinking, the negative voices. You don't have a routine. It's just no good for anybody. We help people in grief that too, you know, stick to a routine. What is helpful? What can you do that you can do every day for, you know, make yourself a list. What do you need to do today? What do you need to do tomorrow? Just to have a goal, a plan. And so, yeah, the pandemic came up and just kind of threw all that out the window. It's like, everybody go home. What am I supposed to do there? I don't have a routine at home. I go to work. I have these meetings. I go to this place. I do that. I do. And so then you're at home. You're on the couch. You're in the bed. You know, you're not getting out of your pajamas. You know, people start leaving the camera off real quick because they're not showering. They're not shampooing their hair. They're not, you know, brushing their teeth. I mean, I am telling you, I've talked to people who that's a real thing. That was hard for them. Like, I'm like, okay, I kind of think you should turn your camera on. Maybe that could be a goal. Let's turn our camera on in your next meeting. That'll give you something to work toward. So when all that structure leaves, then it's almost like we're left to our own devices, and that's just not good. For most of us, you know, we need, like you said, the routine and the structure to keep us moving forward, to give us goal, to give us meaning, to give us purpose. Mm-hmm. And so as at least we are coming back a little bit more, some of us never really left our jobs. So I'm having to remind myself, like, we had our church had our first in-person thing Pentecost Sunday at night. We had everybody could come because it was outside, and we're going to be going back to church in a couple of weeks. And so I forgot how much people missed each other because I go to work, you know, like, oh, yeah, no, it's not a big deal. We're just getting together. Like, no, these people, we haven't seen these people for almost a year and a half. It's a big deal. They haven't seen hardly anybody for almost a year and a half. Mm. It's a big deal. So loss of that connection, that community, that face-to-face, and that routine, that's a really heavy blow for children, adolescents, and adults, you know.
Yeah. It was very funny in the saddest way possible. We were closed for a while, you know, early on with the pandemic at work too, but we were handing out activities and stuff, handing out meals and things like that. And we would have kids come and they would just break down in tears. And they're just like, I just want to go to school. And it's so funny because in a normal time, like pre-2020, you'd ask a kid, do you like school? Do you want to be at school? And they'd be like, no, school is dumb. School is terrible. And then, you know, this happened and all of a sudden they're just like, it's all I want. I just want to see my friends. I just want to go to school. It was heartbreaking. It really was.
Yeah. And the other side of that is that, of course, you know, intimate partner violence has gone through the roof because people have been stuck at home. Child abuse, elder abuse, all of that has kind of shot through the roof because people are stuck at home together. And so, you know, for the people who, and actually it was my son that reminded me of that. He, when all this started and they shut down campuses and everything, my oldest son was coming to Virginia from Illinois. And he was saying, I just feel so bad because I have some friends who don't want to go to their parents. They don't want to go back home. They, you know, and they really shouldn't. It's not a safe place for them. It's not a healthy place for them. I just wish they could all come out here with me. And I'm like, bring them, just go ahead and bring them. You know, Rob's like, calm down. We can't take everybody's kid. We always take everybody's kids. Of course we can. You know? So, like, we're just going to have a huge household. It's like, that's kind of against the rules. Everybody had to our house. So, we always have that problem. But yeah, he was like, yeah, you're right. Not everybody wants to be home with their family. It's not a healthy, good, positive place for them to be. Mm-hmm. So that's been hard too.
That actually kind of feeds into my next question, because that was spurred on by, I'm on a, like a sort of automated text chain with, this is such a weird world, with one of my favorite comic book authors. She just, like, she has a group that she sends like motivational and encouraging posts to at a certain time every day. And she brought up how it's been hard for her and a lot of her friends and her family now to sort of start reentry. And recognize that some of their pre-COVID routines and lifestyles were not healthy ones to go back to. And so now that they're being asked to return to those, say, work routines and stuff, they realize they did not previously have a healthy work-life balance or, you know, healthy relationships, what have you. So, what do you say to those people who are now experiencing a new form of trauma and realizing that they're being asked to return to something that was not healthy for them in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everybody has a point where you kind of have to take a look at where you are. And I actually have some veterans who are in a group that we're running right now. And one of them has asked himself the same questions. You know, he's been able to work from home more this year. And he realized the same thing, that he doesn't have good work-life balance. And it's like you can see the realization as he's starting to go back to work. You can just see it on his face. And he talks about it, but you could just see it on his face in some of our conversations that, oh my God, this is not okay. This is not who I want to be. This is not what I want to be doing. Mm. And so then the question is really, some practical questions. It's a hopeful question. Who do you want to be? What does that look like? And then the practical question, what can you realistically do? Because, you know, you got to have money, right? I mean, that's the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. You gotta pay bills. So what does that mean? I think people are in a really good place right now to negotiate or renegotiate some work from home stuff. You know, if I was able to work from home before, you know, and I was getting it done, then can I take a day a week to work from home? Can I, you know, work from home 2 days a week and then come in whenever? What are those things that would be helpful for you? And some of it's just little things that people weren't doing to begin with. Like I always I always tell our nurses and others, but I work with a lot of nurses with compassion fatigue stuff and with critical incident stress, and I always remind them, take your breaks. You know, you've got 2 15-minute breaks. You've got a 30-minute lunch hour. Are you doing that? Or are you eating at your desk and not really taking your lunch time? Are you taking your break, but people are coming in asking mm-hmm. you questions about patients, you know, and so you're not really getting a mental break? You know, take your break. And if that means you need to leave this floor to do it, then do that. Go for a walk. Get out of this place. Go downstairs and eat, find a place, a quiet somewhere, you know, in the stairwell if you have to, but get away and take your break. And so, you know, and I do that too, just because you get wrapped up in stuff. I'm like, and because we don't have a kitchen and we don't, so we kind of always have to, if we don't go down to the cafeteria, we eat at our desks. But I still try to take a mental break. That's when I'm, you know, looking at my personal email, or when I'm looking on Facebook at pictures, or when I'm texting my family or whatever. I'm taking a mental break, and people don't do that. So is it little things like that? And one thing that I ask people all the time, and not a lot of people have good answers for it, is what do you do for fun? You know, what do you do for fun? And then, you know, we'll have this whole conversation about what is it that you look forward to doing? What are the things that you enjoy doing? What is it that you have to do, but it drains you, that are things that you just wish that you could pawn off to somebody else? Mm-hmm. And then let's go a little bit deeper. Are you doing the things that you say you enjoy doing? I mean, I say I enjoy coloring. Ask me the last time I colored, right? I'm like, if I'm filling out a form about what I love to do, oh, I've got all kinds of ideas, but do I actually do those things? No, I do not. Maybe I did them once in my lifetime and it was fun, and so I put that on my list, but it's not planned in my schedule. I don't make time for it. And on the other side of that is, I encourage people to look at the Eisenhower box. It's Dwight D. Eisenhower. It's his how he used to organize his day, and he had four boxes. And I don't have all the terms on the tip of my tongue, but what I took from it and the way I have utilized it is basically you triage, like we do in healthcare. You triage. This is an emergent need. This is an immediate need. I need to take care of this right away. This is an emergent need, so I need to take care of it, but it's not first on my list today. But by the end of the day, this is something I have to do, but it doesn't necessarily have to be today, or not even, you know, by the end of this week, but I've got to get to it. And then that last box is delegate. What's on my list? What's left on my list that doesn't fit in those three boxes? Then what can I give to somebody else? Maybe that's not even mine. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I just need to delete it. But if it's something that needs to get done, but it's not immediate or emergent or urgent, why am I bothered with it? Mm-hmm. Why am I even thinking about it? So is it mine to do? Is it somebody else's to do? Or is it just not that important and I'm, you know, harping on it? So I talk with people through that, like, what are these things that you think are so important and what really is important? And, you know, when you come down to it, you make time for what's important to you. And Rob and I have always said that. We have done some crazy time management, crazy adult, how many jobs we have and things to make ends meet. We've done some crazy mess in our time together. But we've always said we will make time for what's important. And if it's not important, then we didn't need it to begin with. But you make time for what's important for you. So having those conversations, I think, is just a place to start. Having those conversations with yourself, with your partner, about what is it that we really want. You know, I have a a person that we've been working with as well in a group who decided in this last year that he was done. It's like, I retired from the military. I get a decent pension. I absolutely don't have to work. And when I was working, what I was doing, I didn't love, and it took me away from my kids. And he had a new baby on the way. So they had their new baby just literally like maybe a month ago. And then after the first checkup, he bought, I guess, a camper or an RV. And now he and his wife and their older child and the baby are driving across America and camping out at parks. Because he wants to spend time with his family and he wants to show his kids the beauty of the nation. And just like,
that sounds, you know, very, that sounds very Mitchell and versus the Machines.
I know. But he said, you know, we just realized we don't have to have all this. We're going to downsize. We're going to sell some stuff. We're going to, you know, figure out what we actually need. And we're going to spend time together because that's what's important to me. Like, okay, well, not everybody can do that, right? I mean, not to that scale, but I think that's a good question. Is what we have what we need, or is what we have trying to keep up with the Joneses, you know, trying to keep up with other people, or, you know, buying into the media societal American dream hogwash that is out there, you know? Are we being sold a bill of goods, being told what is what we need, versus what's our actual truth?
Yeah.
So I think this is a good time to kind of figure that stuff out and have those conversations. And it's a scary time to do it as well because of the job situation, because, you know, you're not sure what's going to happen. But every time I talk to somebody who's miserable in their work, I just always ask them, is the work worth it? Is the work worth it? Because you've got one life. And if you are miserable, if you are in a toxic situation, if you are in something that you dread going to every day, is that worth it?
Yeah.
What's it doing to you, to, you know, emotionally? What's it doing to your family? And that's a good conversation to have.
Yeah,
I know there's a thing that I read every day just kind of in preparation for getting ready for the day, and one of the lines in it that I think about quite regularly is, let me just find it real quick. We spend too many hours working to hate what we do. Give 100% of the energy that you have while working and then leave it at the door. And I don't do that great all the time, but I'm in the unique place where for the first time I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. And thinking back 2 years, 3 years, 4 years ago, and the difference between what I was doing then and what I'm doing now, like, I see so much of a difference and recognize the steps that it took to get here and how I'm in some ways grateful for some of the things that happened that made it so I wasn't just jumping at the next thing that would be another job, but this one came along. And I know for me, it's kind of just changed the... a lot of the things that you've been saying, Cindy, about setting goals and things and routines and things, it's stuff that comes up in my workplace all the time. It's conversations I have with my team all the time. And I'm super grateful that I get the opportunity to work in a place that is thinking about this stuff, because my boss today, typically on Fridays, they let us out at 4. And I happened to be still at my desk because I was just a little bit behind buttoning up a couple of things. And at 5:10, my boss was like, why are you still here? Go home. Just shoo. And it was like all but grabbing a broom and shoving me out the door. Like, and she's like, go home. Like, you're tired. Go home. And it's just like, that's this is such an odd environment to where I've worked 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 p.m. at other jobs. And now it's just like, oh. And I thought it's what I wanted to do. I thought that's what it would, I thought that's what it took to get there. And then finding that it isn't kind of was a whole paradigm shift for me.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I see, of course, in healthcare, in a care, in a system full of people who are not all of them, but most people who are typically caregivers just by nature, not all of them. Some of them are just there for the job and there for the money. And you're going to find that anywhere you go. But the ones who are true caregivers, one of the things that I have to, that we all talk to them about and talk to each other about is, are you taking as good of care of yourself as you are taking care of others? Because eventually, if all you do is take care of others, you're going to be empty and you're not going to have anything left to give. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got to be able to balance that out. You've got to take care of yourself so that your caregiving is coming out of a healthy place. Because, you know, hurt people, right? Mm-hmm. I can try with every good intention to help someone, but I may be helping them because I'm fixing my own need. I'm tending to my own need to be appreciated, to be validated, to be someone who just needs to feel needed, to be people pleasing. I may be trying to play out my shame by people pleasing so that I need you to like me. So I'm going to keep doing things for you. So I may not even realize that those are my intentions, mm-hmm. but if I'm not taking care of myself, that's what can come out of that unhealthy caring. And so I talk to people all the time about, can you be as kind and as gentle and as caring to yourself as you are to others? And can you do that for yourself maybe first before you come to take care of others? Because I guarantee you it's going to make a difference in how you do your job.
Yeah.
If you are in a good, healthy place, then what comes out when in your work is going to be really good and healthy for other people. But if you're in a negative place, that stuff shows, man. Everybody sees through that, you know. Mm-hmm. You can tell me how much you love your job and how much you love people and that caregiving is your life, but that's not what anybody sees if you're not taking care of yourself and you're in an unhealthy place. Nobody sees that. They usually see irritability. They usually see, you know, fakeness, you know, that, oh, it's so good to see you today. Like, uh-huh, right. So, you know, you get that. Kids get that really well. Boy, they can read somebody so quick. And we've always said if a kid does not want to like talk to someone or does not want to go see someone, if it's a family member, if it's a friend, and they like are hesitating to like go hug. In my generation, it was always go give him a hug, go give uncle whatever or cousin whatever a hug, and you were just expected to go do that. Well, you know, we are smarter now, and hopefully most of us are. I am. I'm smarter. I don't do that anymore, and I don't make children do that anymore. Let me just get that out there.
I would love to see you try to force Daniel and Thomas to hug anybody.
Exactly. You know, it's not going to happen. You know, it's not going to happen. And so when you see that, they pick up. They know if you're no good. They know if you're fake. They know if you're just negative. You know, people see through that. So you've got to take care of yourself. We talked about, you asked at the beginning, what does trauma kind of do to you? And I want to share a few things that I have been learning about trauma over the last several years. One of the things is that people, I don't know that they realize as much, is that trauma is stored in your body. Mm-hmm. So we think of traumatic memories and we think of trauma responses like combat soldiers and that kind of thing. But any kind of trauma, childhood trauma, any kind of trauma, it's stored in your body. And so people can have trauma responses that they don't even realize are trauma responses if they haven't done any work around that. And so maybe it kind of acts sometimes like grief. So maybe it's just something that you see, something that you smell, a certain place that you go that triggers some kind of little response, makes you fearful, makes you anxious, makes you worried. Maybe it, you know, sends butterflies in your stomach, or it makes you tighten your shoulders, or whatever. Trauma resides in your body. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that is so important, knowing that trauma lives in your body and knowing that we've all been traumatized, is that it's so important for us to actually move our bodies, to actually be active, to move them in meaningful and purposeful ways, whether that is, you know, a walk in nature, whether that is yoga, Tai Chi, in any way that you can move your body. There's something that we do with our veterans, that I do with my veterans, called progressive muscle relaxation, where you go through, we start with your feet and you work your way up the body and you contract and hold the muscle and then you release it. And you literally kind of go through all the different muscle groups so that you can feel the contraction, so that you recognize it, you feel that it's contracted, and then you release it. The hope is that if you can feel that in your body, you're kind of putting yourself back in your body to feel what your body is doing. Because what trauma does is it kind of separates you from your bodily sensations. When a trauma occurs, it's what they call the lizard brain. It's your mm-hmm. fight, flight, or freeze, but it's your lizard brain. It just reacts. Mm-hmm. And in order to keep you alive, in order to survive, the reaction is necessary. But the other thing that it does is that it cuts off your reasoning. It cuts off, literally disconnects from your frontal lobe, cuts off your reasoning, because you don't have time in a survival situation to think about all your options and discuss them and let me pick the best option that's for me. Should I run? Or, well, if I run, I'm going to need to do this. If I stay put, what will happen you don't have time for that, right? If it's a survival situation, you got to react. You got to do something. And so your body knows how to handle that. Your body, you know, wisely shuts off that reasoning and makes you react. What that means is that then that trauma that's stored in your body is stored there without being able to be processed. Mm-hmm. So you may have these reactions and you may not understand why you're having the reactions, because you can't connect the reactions to a reason in your brain. And so one of the things that is helpful, you know, you start having these reactions, you kind of disassociate your body from who you are. You just kind of, almost that feeling of like, if you've ever had the experience of, I just kind of feel like this is an out of body experience. Yeah. Like I see this happening and I can't stop myself. Mm-hmm. Like that happens when I get tired, and the little man in my head that filters all my bad words, he goes to sleep sometimes. Sometimes he takes vacations, like week long vacations, and I can see the things coming out of my mouth and I can hear them, but like there's just no stopping him. That's kind of that out of body experience. And so we have this big disconnect when we have all this trauma. And it's really essential to get you back into your body, to feel yourself, to ground yourself, to feel what your body's doing. And then when you're in a calm state, to then go back and try to think about, when have I felt like that before? You can't think about it when you're having the reaction, but notice it, recognize it, journal it, write it down. And then try to go back later when you're calm and think about, when have I felt like that before? Mm. What is that reminding me of? Mm. That's when you can kind of go back and start working through. that's one aspect of trauma that I think is just fascinating.
That is fascinating.
We do a lot of emphasis on creative arts and journaling and music and body work and deep breathing and stretching, that kind of thing. So I encourage people, if you haven't started a practice like that, you desperately need to. Mm.
Just to add a couple things to what you've just said, Cindy, I know I've been digging into a lot of this stuff recently as well. One of the really helpful things that I've come across dealing with more of the biology side of things and the physical responses to trauma and things like that. So Dan Segal's hand model of the brain. I'll shoot a link over to Alan so he can post it in the show notes. It's a very simple, easy to explain version of you just basically using your hand as a way to understand kind of these basic functions of the brain and that lizard brain versus the frontal cortex and how those interact and how trauma kind of both shapes those and is, you know, affects those. And that's been a huge thing, you know, that I've really pushed with our staff too, is helping people understand, you know, like when we're working with kids, we don't know what home is like for a lot of these kids. Right. And so helping our staff understand, like, yes, that kid is over there throwing a huge temper tantrum right now. I guarantee it has nothing to do with what's going on here. There's something else. Stuff's going on at home. We don't know what home looks like. And unfortunately, for a lot of the kids that we work with, home does not look particularly safe or particularly loving or particularly, you know, functional. And so, you know, these are really big, important things for, I think, everybody to understand. I mean, I would highly encourage everybody to, you know, nobody needs to go and go like full bore, have a full trauma course, you know, go get a bachelor's in psychology or anything like that. But at least get some of these fundamental things and understand. Because it is affecting every single one of us, and you know, it's not just our work lives. It's our friends, it's our family. Like everybody in our lives is experiencing those things. I've talked a little bit. I can't honestly remember when it was. It was a number of episodes ago now, but I talked a little bit about mindfulness, and again, it's very much in the vein of what you're describing, Cindy, about reconnecting that awareness to our bodies and. Being very intentional about the way that we are kind of engaging with our senses. It's very, very sensory work in a lot of ways, right? It's about take the time and actually absorb those experiences. I know one of the things, just as a very quick and easy example that they talk about a lot, is like when you're eating, just eat, you know, and not just eat, but take in the experience, right? Like feel the textures, smell it. Get the flavors. You know, I think so often in our work and move on world, you know, like you were describing with taking our breaks but not taking our breaks, we just scarf down the food while we're still typing reports and sending emails and all that stuff. We don't really sort of acknowledge the experience of eating, and we just get on with our day, whereas mindfulness would tell us, no, slow down, do, you know, take that time, dig into those experiences, really reconnect to that sense of our bodies, and that kind of helps root us in our sense of self in a lot of ways. And those can be very, very powerful tools. I know that's something I've really started doing a lot more in recent months, is pushing myself to like, no, slow down, feel the experiences, like let yourself, you don't need to accomplish 10 things at once. Just be for 5 minutes. It's okay.
Right. Right. And even like the last year, one of the things that I did during the pandemic is, you know, I said that I walked outside a lot and took the dog on a walk. And before we had the dog, the boys were here, and the boys and I would walk a lot. And I would, you know, I like to listen to podcasts, and I like to listen to music and different things like that. But I would intentionally not listen to anything on my walk except nature. And I would take photos of the things that I thought were really cool. So I have these random photos from all of last year of, like, you know, one of those, what are those things, the stick bugs called, that praying mantis that I found, that I was like, oh, wait. And I'm squatting down and taking a picture of praying mantis. And when the slugs came out, I started taking pictures of the slugs. And, was like, what are you doing? It's slugs. They're just really cool. They move really slow. They got that gross slime stuff. I grew up with them, and it brought back memories of Mississippi and walking outside barefooted and stepping on a slug. I was like, oh, God, that's so gross, but they're really cool. Let me take a picture of him. Taking all these pictures, and it's recalling, you know, it's bringing up things for me that I had forgotten about, and, you know, things that are just beautiful that I probably wouldn't have noticed if I had headphones in, you know, and was listening to something else. And I know all the names of all the dogs in the neighborhood. I don't know the people's names, but I know all the dogs' names. And like, oh, that's Chewy's mom and dad. That's Moxie's mom and dad. Nellie's mom and dad live there. Rocky's dad lives there. This is Cooper's house. No idea who the people are, but I know all the dogs. So, from the walk. So it's little things like that. And that really, I honestly, was something that kept me going and kept me sane and gave me kind of it kept me grounded, you know, brought me back to myself, brought me back to nature, brought me back to something bigger than me, and just the beauty in the small things. And, you know, it doesn't have to, I tell people all the time, it doesn't have to take a lot of time. It doesn't have to take a lot of money. It just is, what do you enjoy? What helps you to kind of find beauty in the world around you? What grounds you? What brings you back to yourself? Make time for those things, because that's the kind of stuff that helps to heal that trauma and helps you to find that connection in yourself. One of the things that is so important in trauma work is that trauma disconnects you from yourself. You know, in many ways, you know, we talked about the disconnection in the brain. I really think that's why a lot of childhood trauma sometimes gets buried and forgotten, you know, because children are resilient, miraculous little machines, and they do what they need to do to survive. And sometimes that means burying memories that don't come back for years later when they can actually then maybe handle it. And so you do what you need to do to survive in the moment. Mm-hmm. And then that part kind of gets a little disconnected. So when you are so disconnected with your body and you haven't really done any physical work to reconnect yourself, to find yourself, to ground yourself, it's kind of hard to get to the reasonable trauma, because it all works together. It's hard to get to the mind part of the trauma if you are so disconnected from your body. Mm-hmm. And so you really can't do one without the other. I don't think, not really well. So one of the things I was going to say about things like childhood trauma and even, I would say, survival skills maybe is what I would call them, that they are survival skills in the moment, whether it's childhood trauma or young adult or adolescent or whatever. And then later, those things that helped you survive are things that don't grow well into adulthood. They become, you know, behaviors that are not okay as an adult. And so those, you know, when you then turn to maybe addictions you know, when shame kind of starts kicking in, you turn to people pleasing or bullying or whatever, because, you know, what worked for you back then, it's not going to follow through. So I ask people a lot who have trauma from their past, how did you get through that? How is that showing up in your life now? And how's that working for you? Because usually the answer is, that's not working so well now. You know, when I look back at myself in my 20s and you know, late teens and early 20s, and I could be a little spitfire, but that little spitfire survived a lot. And I needed that to survive a lot. And as I got older and had to deal, you know, with other adults in, you know, business world or in education or in whatever, you know, spitfire had to learn how to calm down a little bit and how to actually have adult conversations and how to, you know, not just always be so defensive and always so, you know, back at people. I'm like, that they don't respond well when you, you know, when you are all up in their face. Maybe I need to try something else. Here's a thought. But that was very helpful. That got me through childhood, adolescence, young adult. Mm-hmm. But it just didn't serve me, you know, and it doesn't serve me later in life. So I had to transition and figure out, what do I need now?
Yeah.
And that's okay. It doesn't mean that, and this is the big thing, it doesn't mean that the child or the teen or the whatever was bad. It just means that's what I needed then. That's what got me through. But right now, I've got to learn a new skill.
Mm.
And so transitioning all that from the trauma, learning from it, finding some way to take meaning and take something that you've learned out of that terrible thing to help move you to a better place. You know, not saying that anything was okay that happens to you, not saying that the trauma was supposed to happen to you or anything like that, but saying that whatever trauma you've experienced, you can't change it. You can't go back and change it. But what you can do is that you can use it as a mechanism to move you forward in a different direction, a positive direction.
What kind of trauma or coping mechanisms do you think children have developed through the pandemic that they might have to unlearn?
I don't know if it's just the pandemic or not, but I imagine it's been hard to get their parents' attention or to keep their teacher's attention or to get noticed in a screen. And so, you know, they may be acting out, they may be yelling, they may be, you know, doing silly, goofy things that are okay when you're at home, but in a classroom setting is not going to fly. It's really not okay when you're at home. And a lot of them have been called out on, you know, you're going to have to take the dinosaur head off for our lesson, you know, and random things like that. My chief has a 10-year-old and she has some really great stories. Like, you can't go to school like that. I'm just going to the living room. So I'm like, okay, you know, so I think listening is probably going to be a problem coming back to school and having to have full attention again when we, you know, how do you do that when you've been able to kind of walk around and roam around and take these lovely breaks for lunch and sit at your own dining room table or whatever and have your toys and your stuff around you when you want it. And now you're going to have to actually go back and have a definitely more structured setting in most places. Not everybody does it that way, but in most places. So I think that's going to be hard. I think you're going to see some separation anxiety, a lot of separation anxiety, because our kids that have anxiety issues already and school refusal issues already have now been home for over a year. And so any kid that has a hard time getting up and agreeing to go to school who's been home for a year, that's going to be hard. That's going to be really hard for our kids who already have those anxieties and those worries. So I think that's just going to be amplified, those types of things. And at the same time, I think it's going to be, there's going to be some transition, maybe not as much as I think, but I think it will be a little weird just to kind of be in a classroom full of kids again.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, maybe there's some anxiety, there would be some anxiety there, but just, I think it just, you know, for the teachers, classroom management kind of stuff, going from Zoom and a few kids maybe to everybody back in place and just relearning that communication, you know, how to communicate with each other, how to navigate difficult situations and with their friends. You know, you can't necessarily treat your friends like you treat your siblings at home or whatever. And in some instances, you know, if they've come from a difficult setting and they've seen, you know, unfortunately, you know, bad behaviors from their parents or from their older siblings, that's going to be hard to come back and kind of be reminded that, no, we don't, you can't do that here. You know, that's not okay.
That's a big one.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's going to be interesting. Really interesting. I think they're going to be excited to go back. It's just going to be transition. But I will tell you, kids are really resilient. Kids are resilient. And I worked with kids when I was in Illinois, and I told a few of them, a few of the classes, but you know, I sounded like an old coot when I did, but I just like, you guys just don't understand how lucky you are to learn these coping skills at this age. You know, I might as well, you know, sound like Moses on the mountain preaching down to Israel. You know, like, they don't care a word about what I'm saying. I'm like, no, really, this is really great information. I wish I learned it when I was your age. You guys are so lucky. They're like, oh, this is over. Get me out of here. She's nuts. You know, I'm like, this is terrible. But I'm like, you know, they really, they will learn and they will transition and they will come through. You know, yeah. I will share one more thing that I've been learning about. It's kind of a newer concept in trauma work. The concept that, this is a scary one, the concept of intergenerational trauma, that trauma is passed down.
Oh, I was going to bring that up earlier, too.
Trauma is passed down from generation to generation, which makes sense to me now, because now it's like, I look at Daniel and Thomas, and I've had so many times where I'm like, you guys have had the best childhood and the best parents. You have no reason to act the way you're acting. I can tell you some stuff. You want to hear some stuff? Let me tell you some stuff, because you haven't experienced anything. You got no reason to be acting like this. You know, I have not said all of those things out loud. I've probably said a few of those things out loud to them, but I've said all of those to Rob, to my husband, all of this. Like, what is wrong with them? Why do they act like this? They didn't grow up like we did. We love each other. This is a great home. Anybody would love to be in our home and have us as their parents. Why are they like this? Right? And so now I'm like, oh, they're like this because I'm like this. Ah, the worst, absolute worst information ever. So, but one of the things that I talk about with my vets, and it's probably really funny for them to hear me say this, you know, all 5'2" of me, the chaplain, sitting in group saying, so let's talk about anger, because I have anger issues. And you know, like, 6-foot vets, you know, they're like, what? Like, it comes down generationally from both sides. My dad had anger issues, all his brothers had anger issues. My grandparents on my dad's side, my grandfather on my mother's side, their parents. I have generations of anger issues. You can see it in me and my brother and my sister. You can see it in my oldest child. We all have anger issues. They're just like, wow. Like, no, really. So let's talk about that. And so then when I say that, the generational piece, they're like, that makes so much sense. My dad was like that. My uncles were like, my grandfather was like that. My whatever was like that. And so you can see it. And it reminds me, I didn't look this up, I should have, but it reminds me of the Old Testament that talks about the sins of the father will be paid. You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, our research is just catching up with God. This is so cool. So long ago. Like, oh my gosh.
Right?
We just didn't understand, but I get it now. It really is. So one of the cool things that I'm learning and that I'm reading, and I will share, this book is tremendous. Resma Menakem's My Grandmother's Hands. I don't know if you know this book, mm-mm, but Resma Menakem talks about generational trauma. And the racialized generational trauma that's passed down to black bodies and white bodies, and how that looks, and how what he says is that in racialized trauma, that when it's passed down from generation to generation, when it's passed down to groups of people, then those trauma reactions become culture over time, become mm-hmm. a culture. We do things this way because this is what was passed down. This is how we survived. This is what we were taught.
Yeah.
And so this book talks about the pathway to mending yourself, mending the racialized trauma in black and brown bodies, in white bodies, and what that feels like and what that looks like. And he does a lot of body work in that as well. He understands that it is connected to your body and has some really good exercises in there. Because one of the things that I've been talking about with my kids, seeing the racialized trauma, the white supremacy trauma that was passed down through to me through my generations before me, like I feel like, you know, I've been doing this work for years and years and years to separate, to relearn, to all this, and I'm seeing the cycle broken in my children, a cycle broken that gives me great hope, because I know where I came from, and to know where I came from and to see them living in a whole different way, that's hope. Like, wow, it worked. Like, it's been a lot of work, but it worked. I mean, now they're like calling me out on microaggressions that I didn't even know I was doing. It's like, I'm the one that taught you guys this stuff. Like, Mom, you can't say that. Like, what? Like, you can't say that. That's a microaggression. I'm like, oh my God, I don't even know what I can say and not say anymore. Now it's beautiful because now they're teaching me. I'm like, what's happened here? So it's been really cool to see that happen in them. And from the anger standpoint, I had a conversation over Christmas with my oldest nephew, and we were talking about the anger and all of that. And he said, Aunt Cindy, we're not passing that down. We are breaking that cycle with our kids. We worked really hard to break that cycle with our kids. And it was just, it was amazing to hear him say that and to, you know, to see something that my dad struggled with so hard and I've struggled with and my sister struggled with. And I know he struggled with it, maybe not to the point that his dad and my sister and I did, but to hear him say that was just, it was hopeful. It was hopeful.
Yeah.
So I passed that along to you as a different kind of trauma that definitely needs to be worked on as well, and encourage you all to think about that book and others that talk about that intergenerational piece and the work that still needs to be done. So
absolutely. Thank you for that resource.
Absolutely.
Well, that's going to bring us pretty close to time for this episode. Cindy, you've unlocked more boxes than I can think of. So at some point in the near future, we may have to have you back on again to talk about some of these other boxes and things that in topics that you've kind of unlocked. Is there anything that we can point folks on the internet to, any projects that you're working on or any anything work related that you'd like to point people to for awareness and such?
Not necessarily that I am working on currently. But I would just point you to research by Bessel van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score. He was one of the first ones that talked about how trauma lives in the body, and the first one to kind of introduce the idea of body work in trauma recovery. So I would, anything by Bessel van der Kolk, that's the book, but he's got a lot of articles out there as well. And obviously, like I said, Resmaa Menakem, There's a lot of good work being done right now in trauma. There's a lot of good work being done in neuroscience as well. You know, they've talked about this for several years now, but the neuroplasticity of the brain, how the brain is actually able to rewire itself. So things that we were once told could not be fixed, you know, that it's just that way. That's not necessarily the belief now, that there are things that can actually work to help you rewire areas of your brain to kind of help you be a little more healthy, so you don't have to experience things like that again. And then I would also encourage you, if you are experiencing any kind of PTSD, any kind of trauma responses, and don't know quite what to do about them, I would encourage you to find a therapist who is certified in EMDR. EMDR is what it stands for, but anyway, it's an eye movement. I'm not going to remember all of it. It's an eye movement training, and it's really fascinating, where the eye movement unlocks a part of the brain that allows you to process the trauma that was in the past unable to kind of be accessed by both sides of the brain. It's something about the rapid eye movement and talking about a particular trauma during the rapid eye movement piece of it that helps you to process. And it's something that I know it sounds like witchcraft. I promise it's not. I'm not doing anything weird here.
I just looked it up real quick. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Yes. And it's something that they use with our combat vets all the time who have PTSD. I would also encourage you, the VA, the VA DOD is really good. The National PTSD, the Center for PTSD, has some really good resources of therapies like acupuncture, reflexology, the EMDR practices, and many others that really are learning more and more about how those help with trauma responses. So it's fascinating stuff. And I love any of the whole health, anything from the whole health practices that you can use to kind of get you back into your body. That's all good stuff.
Well, thank you again, Cindy, for joining us. Mampersands, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, or if anything kind of stood out to you and you'd like to hear more on it. MinMaxPod on gmail.com, MinMaxPod on all the socials except Reddit, where we're /u/MinMaxPodcast. 773-789-9369 is the voicemail number for voicemail. It's 3 minutes or less. Anything longer than that, you can send the audio file to the email address. We choose to respond to those on occasion when we get them dropped into our inbox. I am at Alan H. Myers on Twitter. Ashley is at DEEDEE_K. Kyle's at Stainbrook Kyle. And until next week, we'll see you guys later.